This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In the news, Boeing 737 MAX certification flight tests have concluded. Airbus plans to eliminate up to 15,000 jobs. EASA has updated airline COVID-19 health safety protocol requirements. Aeromexico has filed for bankruptcy. NBAA canceled their convention and exhibition. FAA released Concept of Operations version 1.0 for urban air mobility. Ryanair CEO Michael O'Leary believes it's a buyer's market for the 737 MAX. The NTSB attributed a 2018 uncontained engine failure to a training issue. A320neo airplanes powered by older geared turbofan engines are being replaced. And Alaska Airlines flight attendants will use yellow warning cards with passengers who fail to comply with the airline's in-flight face mask policy. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 611 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hello, Max. Hello, everyone. Looking forward to an interesting discussion. Nothing like talking about FAA rules twice a week instead of just once a week. But more on that later.
All right. Also, here is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year and an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
But most importantly, I get to do Airplane Geeks with you every week. So happy to be here.
Yay. He always finds a way to say the right thing. Also with us is our main man, Micah.
Hey, guys. Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Hello to all the listeners. And what a wonderful summer it's been so far.
Now, we have no guests this episode, just us geeks. Maybe I'll mention longtime listeners know that, well, we have an interesting industry guest almost every episode. But lately, we've had a few episodes here and there with no guests. And it's not because we are giving up on guests, just that I've been kind of off grid a lot lately, don't have the time to schedule guests, get them prepped, get us prepped. So that's the reason why. But yes, we're not giving up on guests, just running a little bit light these days. So why don't we get started with some of the aviation news from the past week? Are you guys all ready?
Ready from the west.
Ready from the east.
And I'm mainly ready.
All right. Well, aviation today has an interesting sort of roundup. It's titled "What's Trending in Aerospace." A lot of shorts here, maybe, that we can take a look at. Some of these are pretty important. For one, Boeing and the FAA have completed the certification flight testing for the 737 MAX. So that's done. There isn't a lot of detail about how that went. Everybody seems to be saying, well, it went well. The FAA has to take a look at the data that they collected during these test flights, and then we'll see what happens next.
You know, if the FAA certifies that based on what's happened with the FAA recently and our feelings about it worldwide, what happens with the rest of the world and other agencies? Does it need to be certified every place again?
Well, the other agencies need to issue the directives that would put the plane back in service. I guess, Micah, the open question is, what are they going to base that decision on? Are they going to just sort of rubber stamp the FAA's decision? Are they going to want to do their own analysis? I don't know if we know.
Well, isn't several other organizations like the Europeans and some of the other Asian countries want to do their own certification? So just because the FAA certifies it, I have a feeling it's going to be triple checked and quadruple checked.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, I mean, whether or not there will be a requirement for additional test flights is a good question. I mean, maybe these other regulatory agencies around the world can use the data that's been collected for these test flights. I don't know. It'd be an issue, I think, if additional flights are required in order to satisfy those regulatory agencies' desire to do their own certifications.
It'll be curious to see where the FAA stands worldwide now.
Well, yes, because they have a reputation that got somewhat damaged as a result of this. Yeah, I'm curious to see how quickly that gets repaired. I think it will get repaired, maybe not instantly, but I don't know. I'm thinking it maybe won't take too long. Hopefully.
Well, I think they're going to be more interested in being involved this time around, simply because of, you know, the two crashes. EASA has expressed interest in getting involved in recertification, as has Canada. There is a note out about 10 days ago that said that EASA has been prevented from traveling to the U.S. Because of COVID-19 restrictions to schedule MAX recertification flights. So my guess is there might actually be a delay in getting it certified for use again in Europe.
Meantime, Airbus is saying that they may eliminate up to 15,000 jobs by next summer, summer of 2021. The Airbus CEO described the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic as, quote, the gravest crisis this industry has ever experienced. And he said that in a June 30th press release. So 15,000 jobs, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of that in the travel industry, both for the airframers as well as the airlines themselves, bound to be a lot of cuts.
Yeah, I would agree. And I don't think there's going to be an immediate bounce back either. There's kind of a delay in the economic impact. So even if the public starts traveling by air to a greater extent, I don't think the aviation companies around the world can recover with the same speed. If anything, you know, be a lot slower and more delayed. And then, Max, you mentioned EASA. They've updated their airline COVID-19 health safety protocol requirements. And in that, we see a couple of new safety directives. They relate to cleaning and disinfecting of aircraft. The new requirement is at least once every 24 hours cleaning and disinfecting, or, quote, more frequently if deemed necessary on the basis of the operator's risk assessment.
That's going to be a take out an airplane for several hours. You know, that's going to change scheduling a lot.
Maybe not so much right now just because the schedules are so light, but you're right. I don't think they could sustain that with a normal schedule.
You know, there's also the issue, when we think of, you know, how long does it take to clean and disinfect an aircraft, we see a lot of videos, sometimes at the airport, sometimes on airplanes, but in other industries as well. And you watch the people, quote, cleaning and disinfecting. It's oftentimes a sort of a cursory spray of something, you know, a wipe quickly across at least part of the surface. It doesn't really strike me often as a really thorough job. If you clean every surface, every bit of every surface in the interior of an airplane, you know, that's a lot of cleaning. That could take quite a while, but I don't know if that's what we'll actually see.
The only saving grace about that and that whole issue is more and more studies are coming out that it's not the transmission is not surface based, but more it's via the droplets and oral and transferred through the air. So I'm sure they're going to have to reevaluate strategies. But, you know, if you're going to err on the side of wiping down a thing or wearing a mask, wear a mask. It's a much more effective protection.
You know, I'm wondering if the aircraft builders will come out with an option available with an ultraviolet light kit that can be installed into the aircraft so that you can actually disinfect the aircraft by emptying it and turning on the ultraviolet lights that disinfect it as they do in air handling systems and things like that.
Yeah, there's a company I've seen which is offering that, I think, for private charter type aircraft. I don't recall that they've installed it yet in the airliners, but yeah, I did see a press release out that for things like Gulfstreams and things like that.
And for building interiors, I've seen it's almost like a robot or something that goes down the hallway with ultraviolet emissions to disinfect everything. But EASA also has, in this directive, a requirement that if an aircraft has had a passenger that tested positive for COVID-19, that it has to stop operating that aircraft, quote, unless after that identification, the aircraft is cleaned and disinfected using substances suitable for aviation use. So, I mean, if you're cleaning it at least once every 24 hours, if there was a passenger on there who is tested positive for the virus, I mean, how soon are you going to know that?
Yeah, I was going to say that's at least 48 hours.
Yeah.
Hopefully no one is going to get tested and then get on an airplane without knowing the results. You know, and then get off the airplane and find out, oh, yeah, your doctor just called. You need to quarantine for 14 days.
That's a little bit of health theater to me, because technically if they're using the universal precautions when they're doing the initial cleaning anyway, that secondary thing isn't necessary unless they find out that it's happened in between that 24-hour period. So doesn't make a lot of sense if they're using universal precautions and universal cleaning.
And that's consistent, because we've talked a lot at airports having security theater, so now there's health theater.
Yeah, yes. Well, also in this Aviation Today piece, they note some Latin American airlines have filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They note Aeromexico, sort of the latest filing in less than 2 months. Chile has had an airline fold. Colombia has as well, Avianca. We are seeing airlines that are, you know, just not able to keep up with the cash payments, and so are going bankrupt. I think we'll see a number more. Also, NBAA has canceled the 2020 Business Aviation Convention and Exhibition. That was scheduled for October, early October in Orlando, Florida, but they've canceled that. I guess that's not a huge surprise. Almost every conference and convention has been canceled for this year, so that's not a surprise, I don't think.
Well, it's interesting that they canceled it and not went to a virtual or a, most of the trends, especially on the other show, on UAV Digest, a lot of those conferences have gone to virtual conferences. In this case, it's a straight out cancellation.
Yeah.
Have you noticed, though, that the months are going so incredibly fast, yet at the same time, incredibly slow all at once? I mean, it feels like it was March yesterday, yet that's 3 months ago. But at the same time, it feels like 100 years ago. And soon it's going to be September, October, no wonder. I mean, it's going to come right up.
And things probably won't have changed that much.
Yeah.
Groundhog Day has got a few more months to go, I think.
I think you might be right. But business aviation is seeing some good news. While the NBAA convention is off, GoGo seems to have its finger on the pulse of business aviation, because they can see the data that shows flights using their in-flight connectivity systems. And they've seen an increase. It's reached 3,000 daily flights. And the single day low point in mid-April was 378 daily flights, so we're up significantly from that. And then one more item in this article, this roundup of things to be watching, the FAA and NASA
have developed their first concept of operations document for urban air mobility operations. So this is version 1.0. And so it's, well, as they say, it's intended to be kind of a common frame of reference, sort of a starting point to flesh this out in more detail, this being urban air mobility and the, you know, the concepts that bring unmanned aircraft, drones, for example, into the national airspace system along with manned aircraft. And so we're looking at it here from an urban air mobility standpoint.
Well, I guess it's going to be a little bit more crowded down below 400 feet AGL and probably a little bit more risky for helicopters and other aircraft that are down there and usually expect to have it to themselves and don't expect to have drones running around.
Yeah, and the pace with which these things get addressed from a regulatory standpoint, of course, is not speedy. You know, there will be a lot of opportunity to examine these concepts, to comment on them, and so forth. The FAA has consistently sought input from stakeholders, of which there are a lot when it comes to things like urban air mobility and sharing the airspace. So what do you think, David? Do you think this is maybe 2 years off?
Times 10?
Times 10.
No, I jest a little bit, but in our urban air mobility and UAS world, it seems like everything just seems to take forever. Unmanned air systems or remotely piloted systems, it's been taking forever. It'll be interesting to see with the major stakeholders like Boeing and Airbus who are playing in the air mobility field, if they can get some sort of leverage on the FAA to move forward quicker. You know, there are a lot of high stake players in the urban air mobility. You know, now that the economy's bottom's dropped out, who knows who will survive that. But I think urban air mobility will be the driver, and then UAS and delivery by drones, etc., will be what goes on forward.
So it's an interesting article. There's a few other items in there. We haven't gone over them all. Anything else from that article that anyone wants to bring up?
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting to see the Phenom 300E, which is one of the most popular light jets. And they mentioned the first delivery to a Texas law firm. That, to me, isn't the big part of the story. The big part of the story is some really neat technology they have that I've been reading about recently. They have the first aircraft with ROAS. And, of course, I know everybody wants to have ROAS, right?
I've been waiting a long time for ROAS.
I couldn't live without ROAS. No, it's an acronym for, which I'd never heard of before, for Runway Overrun Awareness and Alerting System. And it is really, really, really slick. We have gotten the accident rate for, jets down very, very low. And yet we still continue to have some runway overruns where airliners and private jets come in too hot and too fast and they run off the end of the runway. And there are enough of those accidents around where if you could eliminate those, that would really help get the accident rate down. And so what this system does is that it's got a number of different criteria. And it, for example, I think it kicks in around 500 feet above the ground. And at that point, if you've got, for example, too high a descent rate, or if you're projected to land too far down the runway, it'll actually tell you, go around, or overrun alert, things like that. And then as you get really close to the ground, I think down 30 feet above the ground, for example, it'll change from a yellow caution to a red warning telling you to go around. And if you're on the runway, it'll actually tell you overrun alert, break. So I think it's just a fantastic system. It does the kinds of things that pilots are supposed to do but don't always do. And so I think that's great that, that's been rolled out. Hopefully other aircraft will have that. It's also, they've also rolled out predictive wind shear. And I hadn't realized until fairly recently, but wind shear can be identified by onboard radar. And so they've written new algorithms that take a look at the direction of wind movements using radar. And they can now predict wind shear up to about 5 nautical miles in advance. So a lot of great new stuff packed into this jet, and I think we'll see this roll out into other jets in the future as well.
It's interesting how the industry gets incrementally safer. You know, these kinds of improvements come along, you know, kind of all the time. Sometimes small things that add up, sometimes big things. But it kind of goes back in my mind to the point that we were talking about, David, about how long it's been taking the regulatory agencies to, you know, establish the rules for remotely piloted unmanned aircraft. Because when you look at manned aviation, I mean, we're still making it safer and better. We've got all of these, you know, 100 years or whatever it's been of, you know, these gradual improvements that increase the safety of flying. And we don't have that, that long history when it comes to unmanned aircraft. Now, of course, the unmanned sector benefits some from what's been learned over the years in the manned arena. But still, it represents such a different technology, and it just doesn't have the, you know, the length of time necessary to figure out all the little improvements that, you know, will happen in the future.
You know, Max, I'm curious from your perspective, what do you think those electronic help gadgets do to pilot, ability? I'm thinking about it. I don't know if I mentioned it here or someplace else, but I had I got a loaner car. I got a Subaru with EyeSight Drive built into it. And I'm driving down the road and I had it turned on and it's steering for me and it's taking care of the speed for me and it's keeping me from, you know, moving off the road and it has me in the center, but I think I should be more one way to the other and I'm fighting with the car. But, you know, I'm a rather aware and long-term driver that I've been driving this way for a long time. I think if I grew up with that, I would be far less alert when I'm driving. And I'm wondering how you feel as, you know, CFI, how you feel that's going to affect your students and future pilots.
Oh, I think that is a trade-off that we see with a lot of these new technologies. They help, but they can also sometimes make people a little bit more complacent or over the long period of time, a little bit less knowledgeable about the, you know, the underpinnings of, you know, what's happening and, you know, why it's important that these systems do what they're doing. I think on the net, it's an improvement, but you're right. I think for any step forward, there's always a little bit of a half step, you know, backward over time as well.
But it's an interesting point, Micah, because the environmental factors, I think, affect your safety as an operator, as a pilot or whatever. I've talked to motorcycle riders, for example, who, after they started riding motorcycles, became much better drivers because a motorcycle is obviously much more affected by the actions of others around them. In other words, automobiles and so forth. And so being a safe motorcycle operator means having greater situational awareness than would otherwise be the case, maybe, for someone driving an automobile. And so that affected them. So it's kind of the inverse of what you're saying, maybe, Micah, is that, you know, as automation increases, is there a tendency to, you know, for the human being to be less safe because of the reliance on that? Yeah, it's an interesting, it's kind of a dilemma. I think maybe, you know, when companies are designing automation systems, it's something that needs to be kind of considered in the design. You know, how do you keep the human being engaged enough so that the reliance on the automation doesn't just remove, you know, any desire from the on the part of the person to keep themselves safe?
Yeah, that whole area of human factors, I think, is a ripe area for even more research. I wanted to jump back just a little bit to our conversation about the national airspace being readjusted for drones. I just saw an article, I think today, which mentioned that there have now been, according to this article, 6 different, you know, drone on mostly helicopter type strikes. And they didn't even count the 7th one, which I think we talked about occurred in Canada fairly recently. I was surprised that there have been that many.
Yes, there do seem to be a lot, although I guess helicopters and drones, the airspace they fly in, there's maybe a little bit more overlap. Maybe that's why.
Well, the good news in all those cases, they said that there hadn't been any injuries to the pilots involved, and that they were able to successfully land the helicopters, even though most of them had some kind of damage.
Yeah, the drones didn't make out so well, though.
No, in fact, in this latest one, they basically called it a drone strike based on the marks on the helicopter, even though they could not find any trace of a drone afterwards.
Yeah, not surprising. Well, anytime Ryanair CEO Michael O'Leary is in the news, it's almost always a good story. And Max, what do we see here in Forbes?
Well, basically, Michael O'Leary says, never overlook a down economy to try and get a good deal. So he's basically hoping that he can use the position that Boeing is in, which is a pretty precarious one right now, to buy more 737 MAXs and to get a really good deal on them. So he basically says, if the MAX is flying in September or October this year, I'll be disappointed if we're not in active negotiations with Boeing to buy more of the MAXs. So, yep, he's always out there looking for the best possible deal.
And you can't blame him. I mean, that's what I would do, and if I was in his position. Ryanair's fleet is pretty substantial. They on their website, Ryanair says that they have over 450 Boeing 737-800 series aircraft, orders of up to 210 new Boeing 737 aircraft. So obviously they're a big operator. In addition to it being a buyer's market, perhaps being a big operator also has an advantage as well. So
that's a lot of 737s. I didn't realize they were that big.
They're big and they're young. They also note, and this is again from the Ryanair webpage, so I don't know how recently this was updated, but they say they're the average age of the Ryanair fleet is approximately 6.5 years. That's young. And of course, if he does have add a new order to the numbers there, that'll just bring that average age down even more. But it's not surprising. It's also noted that after 9/11, Ryanair ordered 100 737s. So yeah, I think he's picking his timing.
Well, it would be fun to be sitting on the wall listening to those negotiations. I think another leverage point that he's going to have is just the number of used aircraft that are going to be relatively cheap on the market because some of the airlines are either going bankrupt or reducing their fleet sizes. So, boy, it's really going to be a huge opportunity to scoop up aircraft, whether they're slightly used or brand new ones.
Well, Southwest would be in the same boat because they're all 737s. They have 745 in service and 276 of the MAXs on order. So I think, they're going to be able to negotiate pretty well with Boeing.
Yeah, if they need more. And Ryanair has the cash to do it, too. It's reported that Ryanair's cash position is on the order of 4 billion euro. So, They have the cash.
But are they going to get the stand-up toilets?
Yeah. Yeah, or the pay toilets. Yeah. Oh, Leary. You got to love him. Austrian Airlines is another airline that's, struggling like they all are. And they recently received a government aid package, which has some interesting provisions. Max, did you see that?
I did. This really caught my attention. I was lucky enough to spend a semester abroad in college in Vienna, so I'm always kind of interested in Austria anyway. But this was interesting because they said that basically, as part of the deal to get this money from the government, not only do they have to cut their domestic emissions by 50% by the year 2050, but they also have to end flights where there's a direct train connection to the airport that takes considerably less than 3 hours. And, if you think about the push in Europe in particular for green aviation, I wonder if we're not going to see a lot more of this from other countries that are going to say, let's try and get some of these people out of the sky and put them into fast rail service.
Right.
So, for example, in this year, starting from July 20th, they're going to have 31 direct train services a day between Vienna and Salzburg, up from just 3 rail connections per day. So it looks like they're going to be taking people out of the sky, putting them into the train. I think it's probably a little easier to do in some cases in Europe just because some of these airlines have been government-owned, and I sort of vaguely remembered that Austria Airlines was, and I looked it up, and they actually got privatized by the government back about 8 or 9 years ago. But also, a lot of the countries strive to have universal rail service. So the country is in charge of the rail service, and they lose money, but they will serve every little tiny town of 10 people in the middle of nowhere. So it makes it much, much easier to do that. Plus, of course, Europe is a lot more densely packed people-wise than the United States is here. We are just have large population centers that are spread out over many hundreds of miles. There they have population centers that are scattered by dozens of miles. So I'm not sure this could be replicated elsewhere, but it's really interesting because I think it might portend some of the kinds of changes we're going to see going on, particularly in Europe in the future.
Well, it's already happened in France. One of the contingencies when the government of France bailed out Air France was that Air France could no longer compete with domestic train travel of anything longer than 2 hours and 30 minutes by train. So Air France had to cut their flights from Paris to Bordeaux to Lyon I'm going to mispronounce the towns, but I think it's Nantes and Rennes. But it makes sense. And frankly, I wish that we here in the U.S. had train service that allowed us to do that. If I had a choice of taking a train from Portland to New York or to D.C. and nonstop, I would always do that as opposed to flying because it's quick. You know, we here in the megalopolis from Boston to Washington, D.C., there's no nonstop trains, and you really should be able to go from Portland to Richmond on a nonstop, well, not nonstop, but the same single train, and we don't have that availability.
Yeah, we're definitely operating in a different environment, and so I can't think of an
Eastern Seaboard trip, even on the Acela. I mean, New York to D.C., I think, is longer than 3 hours.
Yep.
So, I mean,
is that because the train is so slow?
No, I mean, yes. that's the Acela, the limited stop, high speed. Yeah. And so, I mean, if you need to get to New York from LaGuardia down to Dulles or National, that's an hour flight, if that. I don't know where we could replicate that whole, maybe California. If you put in high speed rail between Los Angeles and San Diego, but that's been
proposed many, many, many times, and they started building it, and then they've stopped building it. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, rail travel from San Francisco to Los Angeles, that wouldn't be 3 hours.
No, that's a good 5.5 hour, drive if you're lucky.
But the equation changes a little bit with airport security, right? When you look at the time to get from your house to the airport and get parked and get into the terminal, then go through the security process and get checked in, there's a lot of time between you walking out your door and you stepping onto the airplane that I think, at least for me, in many cases, is longer than the time in the air that I'm going to spend after I get in that airplane.
Sure. It's about an hour drive. Isn't it about an hour drive from Pennsylvania Station in Philadelphia to the airport, more or less?
It's 15 minutes by rail, and it's in bad traffic. It might be 30 minutes. It might be, but, I mean, Philadelphia National International down to downtown is... That's pretty much a piece of cake unless it's rush hour. But even then, you're only adding about 10 minutes more to it.
Yeah, that's one of the few city airports that's right smack next to the city, which is pretty handy.
It is. All right, from Bloomberg, Pratt & Whitney's in the news.
And what did you do, Max?
Yeah, nothing. I'm retired. I just collect the pension. So this goes back to an uncontained engine failure. In 2018, It was the United Airlines 777-200 with Pratt & Whitney PW4077 engines. It was flying from San Francisco to Honolulu, and it experienced an uncontained engine failure when a fan blade broke loose. Say that fast. Or as we like to say, David, liberated.
Yes, that's right. Liberated.
A fan blade liberated. Anyway, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, issued a final report, and it really points to a training issue, which is always interesting. The NTSB says that in their investigation, they found that two previous inspections of that very same blade had revealed some weakened material in the titanium. But the inspector interpreted these indications as relating to the way the blade was painted. So he saw the indications, but I don't know if it was a he or a she, but the inspector saw the indications and thought that they were not an issue. So
when do you paint blades?
Oh, you know, make them nice and black, you know, with a little.
Really?
These are the fan blades, right? So these are the blades you see when you look in the front of the engine.
Okay, they usually look silver to me, but okay.
Yeah, right. Sometimes. Yeah, they're not always painted, but in any event, so the cause of this was, it's kind of interesting. I don't fully understand it, but the inspection process had been classified as a, quote, new and emerging technology. And apparently, when you have a process, an inspection process that is a new and emerging technology, then you can continue to permit inspections, but you don't have to develop a formal, defined, initial and recurrent training program or an inspector certification program. That's from the NTSB. So those training programs, or that program, was apparently not developed. And so that resulted in this interpretation of the indications seen by the inspector. Now, I don't know how long a process gets to remain classified as a new and emerging technology. And if the real failure here was that, you know, it didn't transition away from that into something that required a formalized program, I don't know what all the, you know, the cause is behind that. It's another example of you start out with something terrible like an uncontained engine failure. And the plane, obviously, it lost that engine. There was, I think, material from the front of that engine housing that impacted the airplane, the fuselage and all, but it successfully landed with the one remaining engine. And after that, Pratt & Whitney reinspected all of the fan blades across the fleet, which was 9,600 fan blades, and they didn't find any other fan blades that had a potential safety problem. So it was just that one fan blade out of the entire population.
Of course, they use that same inspector to do those inspections, right?
Yeah, that's right.
they all look like paint to him, no problem. Hey, I'm curious, what's the benefit to Pratt & Whitney or to any company to taking advantage of this new and emerging technology classification and not creating training? Is it to try and, you know, keep new technology secret from your competitors, or why would it be classified in such a way that they don't have to give training to people?
I'm not 100% certain, but I believe it's because there's something about it that's so new that you're not able to finalize what that training or what that certification should be.
Oh, that's just awful. That's, I don't know what I don't know, so therefore I'm not going to train it.
That's right. Yeah.
But it's good enough to be used by, you know, people flying airliners.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds definitely like something an engineer would come up with. Speaking as the son of an engineer, I don't know it, so why should I train it?
Does sound like a loophole, though. I mean, it's a real problem in this particular case.
Thankfully, no, there were no injuries or anything like that. But yeah, I think I would be a little shaken up if I was a passenger and heard a loud bang and looked out the window and saw the front end of one of the engines missing. Doesn't inspire confidence.
I don't want to hear a loud bang anywhere near an airplane, especially when about where, no matter where it's coming
from. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, especially when you're 200 miles from Hawaii.
Yeah, always makes me nervous when the engines start to spool down and get quiet. There are some noise abatement procedures, such as coming out of Orange County Airport in Southern California, where they climb to 2,000 feet and then haul the end, you know, just haul back on the throttle, and you're like, whoa, yeah. Did the engines quit, or is this just the normal noise abatement procedure?
On that flight.
So Pratt & Whitney's also in the news here from LiveMint.com. This is Pratt & Whitney to replace old faulty engines before deadline. So I think we've touched on this a few times. There are a lot of A320neo airplanes sold into India, and a lot of them powered by geared turbofan engines. And IndiGo and Go Air have had problems with those engines, in-flight shutdowns. I guess the issues have been identified, and Pratt & Whitney is replacing those older geared turbofan engines. They have an August 31st deadline, 2020. They say that they will beat that deadline. They have swapped out 220 of IndiGo's 250 engines, and for Go Air, they've swapped out 60 of the 86 engines, so they're getting close. There was a previous deadline for doing this. It was May 31st, but that was extended because the airlines couldn't comply because of the lockdown. So the government or the regulatory agency in India gave them an extension to August 31st, which I guess they'll be meeting.
Max, you know, I remember 8 to 10 years ago, we had a guest on the Geeks who was one of the designers of the geared turbofan. We were talking about the geared turbofan like it was a dream. It was going to be coming out, and now here it is. And there have been a lot of problems with it that we've just discussed, and with the A220 C-Series. Have they been worked out? I mean, is a geared turbofan something that's now a workable regular engine without all the newness to it? I mean, what can you tell us about where it is right now?
Well, I think it's kind of like any new piece of complex equipment is that, and it kind of goes back to what we were saying before about aviation in general, there's a continuous process of improvements based on issues as they come up, based on accumulation of hours and cycles. So it's almost a continuous process. There's never really any point at which development completely ceases, pretty much. So, you know, is it a fully mature engine? Well, you know, maybe not fully mature. Is there any real cause to be concerned that you're flying on an airplane that, you know, is not tested out or is not proven or anything? No, I don't really think so. In the case of the airlines in India, I mean, you know, it was very specific issues with them. I think it was the low-pressure turbine failures that they were experiencing. I think, if I recall correctly, the third stage of the low-pressure turbine. And, you know, those kinds of things can be caused by the operating environment of a particular operator. It can be caused by the way the pilots fly the aircraft. You know, are they adhering to engine D rate, or are they, you know, lead footed, basically, that can have a big impact on the condition of the engine, how quickly it wears, or how it wears, or how it's affected by that. So in India, there were just situations, there were conditions that were different than elsewhere. So this is kind of a specific to those airlines issue.
So you got a bad block of engines flown by Indians whose safety records in their hot and high climate have really bad reputations. That's a scenario for a lot of bad happening.
Well, I just wanted to mention that there was a story that came out about 10 days ago. I talked about this last week on Aviation News Talk. And according to India's Directorate General Civil Aviation, they have arrested an Air Indigo pilot because he faked his written exams to get his pilot's license. They also arrested a captain from the national carrier Air India for the same thing. And as part of this investigation, they have said that there are possibly 3,000 to 4,000 pilots who are now being scrutinized, possibly for fake licenses. This is at the same time that we're hearing Pakistan, I believe, has 860 pilots in the country, and something like 40% of those licenses were believed to be fake. So I can tell you that certainly if I look at general aviation pilots, yeah, the better trained ones are much nicer to the engines than the poorly trained one. And so it's entirely possible that people who have fake pilot's licenses just aren't as good, you know, at operating engines and don't truly understand the ramifications of why you're supposed to follow all the guidelines.
And my other comment was, in India is not necessarily a high pressure environment for engines. It's a hot and high climate, you know, so you're using those engines different than you're flying across the country in the plains of the United States. You're flying in mountainous terrain with dust and heat. So there's just a lot of bad there, but good for Pratt & Whitney for fixing the engines.
And I don't know if the changes that have been made to the engines are changes or apply to engines only sold into that market, or if it's a type of change that's then, you know, introduced into the production engines for all of them, for everybody. I have no idea. You really don't like to, you know, manufacture operator specific or region specific equipment if you can avoid it, for obvious reasons. It just complicates, you know, a lot of things. So I don't know what's been done here with that.
Yeah, and you think about all the problems we had with engines in the desert and the various wars that we've had in the Middle East. And yeah, no question, engines don't like hot temperatures and dust and things like that.
Yeah, sand. Engines do not like sand.
Dow, don't be so abrasive.
You think I'm being too rough on it? Well, all right.
Getting down to the nitty gritty.
Yeah. So I kind of like this this next item. Alaska Airlines kind of taking a cue from what they do in, what we would call soccer, or what the rest of the world would call football.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. There has been a lot of arm wrestling that's been going on between flight attendants and passengers over masks. And nobody likes having to enforce rules when, some people are pretty adverse to following the rules. And there have been some cases of airlines have, banned passengers for a number of months, saying, hey, you didn't follow our rules, and therefore you can't fly with us again. Well, Alaska decided to get a little bit creative with this, and they borrowed something from soccer. And so apparently now, the first time someone gets a violation for not wearing a mask or following some other similar kind of rule, just like in soccer, they're going to get a yellow card. It's a warning for passengers who refuse to wear a mask. And it says, this is your final notice to comply with our policy. Next, we will file a report, which could result in suspension of future travel of Alaska Airlines. I mean, it's a bright yellow card. And boy, it would certainly get my attention. I was given one of these, and I would think twice about whether I want to, not follow the rules.
You got to go for the red card. You got to go for the red card then.
I think it maybe would make life a little bit easier for the flight attendants as well. Instead of having to verbalize the same message that these cards are intended to give, you can just hand the card and say, read this, and this is the point. But we see here that any passenger who repeatedly refuses to keep the mask on, we'll get one of these warnings. And Alaska did acknowledge that there are exceptions to the mask rule. Of course, all the U.S. airlines now require masks to be worn except when eating or drinking. But Alaska has some exceptions as well. There's exceptions for small children, for persons with medical issues that affect their ability to breathe and things like that. Also, Alaska will offer a free mask to anyone who doesn't have one. And they are also starting this month. So I guess by now they've started to provide individual hand sanitizer wipes on board. But as far as the rules, face masks are required for all guests 12 and over. Also, all employees. I guess it doesn't matter if you're under 12 and an employee. If you're an employee, you have to wear a mask. Children under 2 do not have to wear masks, although there's no requirement for people under 12, but the airline's recommending that anyone older than 2 and under 12 wear a mask. It has to cover your mouth and your nose. Should be on at all times, Alaska says, except when you're eating or drinking. And they're going to be rolling out additional hand sanitizing stations at airports and check-in lobbies and gate areas. So I don't know that they could do much more than that.
You know what's interesting about that is that they've been saying that children are far less symptomatic than adults are. And the children could have COVID-19 and not necessarily have symptoms. Yet they're saying that children under 12 don't have to wear a mask, and they may be the most infectious.
Yeah.
Yeah, my wife and I have a special name for young kids without masks. We refer to them as Petri dishes.
But to put a different spin on it, being a football fan and a soccer fan, the image of a flight attendant walking down the aisle snapping a yellow card into the air and pointing to the person in the seat before handing the yellow card. I think that's great, well-rounded humiliation. You know, that image in my head makes me very excited that good for Alaska Airlines, you know. I want them to see her walk down the aisle, hold up the yellow card so everyone sees it, and then hand it to them.
Well, you didn't mention the best part of all. Apparently, they're changing the uniforms now. They're going to be black with white stripes. So I think that's great. Well, yeah.
But I really feel for the flight attendants. I mean, they have such a bad – not a bad. They have such a difficult job at times, you know, as it is. And now to, you know, layer on this, you know, enforcement of – requirements for masks and all, it's a lot. Those people are, I don't know how they do it sometimes.
Yeah, they're certainly not as well paid as they should be. Kind of reminds me of teachers. You know, we ask a lot of teachers and they're not super well paid. I think the same thing goes for a flight attendant. So yes, I'm happy that a lot of them do the job and do it so well.
All right, what's up with the geeks? David Vanderhoof, you've been out doing aviation stuff, I understand.
Yeah, I needed to get out of the house. I needed to pick up that thing that I have that was sitting in the corner calling my name, called a camera. We're very blessed that in the middle of Bucks County, Pennsylvania, is a small little grass strip called Van Zandt's Historic Airfield. It was a place that my parents took me to when I was a little kid, and it's an old school grass field. They have biplanes. They have a beautiful Stinson, and they have 01 bird dogs, and they have a Piper PA-25 air tractor that's painted up as dusty from planes. And I struggled with our flyover the day before for the DC area, and it sort of made me angry. And I was very blessed that Van Zandt made me reminded me of why I love aviation. It was people sitting at picnic tables, having a picnic lunch, having some sodas with their dogs, airplanes coming and going, you know, people having a good time, hamburgers cooking on the grill, hot dogs, you know, $2 for a hot dog and $1 for a Coke, you know, to watch airplanes come and go on a simple grass field. It's pure aviation. It was pure joy. And after 100 plus days of being trapped in and not having air show season and other things, it was really nice to get out and see airplanes, or more to the point, see people interacting with airplanes, you know, and smelling aviation fuel and just the noise of a reciprocal engine going by. So it was a really, I was there for, Max and I were talking before the show. It's funny, as a photographer, I got home and I was like, oh, I'll have like 100 pictures maybe, you know, that I took. I had come home with 500 plus for 2.5 hours. You know, it is kind of amazing what digital photography does for you. You don't realize how much you're shooting anymore. One of the comments I made to Max before was, I would go to Andrews Air Force Base in the late 80s with my Pentax K1000 with a whopping 8 rolls of 36 exposure Ektar film. And that was going to last me the whole weekend, you know. And I look back at some of those photographs, and I look at not what I took in front, but I look in scenes like in 1991, what was behind the aircraft I took a picture of, and going, why didn't I take a picture of that? Because you just didn't have a lot of, I mean, A, you paid up front for the film, but film was cheap. But developing wasn't. So, you know, I mean, I had a really good time. I'll put Van Zandt's airport's website in the show notes. And like I said, it's a sleepy little grass field. You take back roads and covered bridges and to get there. And you just open up onto this wide green field with old, beautifully sexy airplanes that, you know, don't have jet engines and don't drop bombs and don't carry people, but airplanes for the sake of flying around, being airplanes for people to enjoy.
Sounds like a great day, David.
Yeah, and my only reaction is, Daddy, tell me another story. No, it's so nice. It really is. I'm very envious. I'd love to have been there. I'm glad you had such a good time. And yeah, thanks for sharing that with us.
I'm looking forward to, I've made a mental note that I'm going to go back in the fall. It's surrounded by low hills and stuff, but if I remember correctly, if we have fall during leafer season, all of those airplanes taking off and landing with the seas of oranges and reds and greens behind it, it will be a wonderful time to take pictures.
Have you ever made it up to Lock Haven, by the way, where the old Piper factory is located?
I did. I have, yeah. It's funny. There was 2 Piper Cubs tooling around the airport, you know, and it's so cool. Just, you know, the doors were hanging down, and you take a 300 millimeter lens, and you could basically, you're so close to these guys taking off and landing, you can read the instruments from a 300 millimeter lens. It's just fun. It's enjoyment. And it's the kind of feeling you get at that other air show in Wisconsin. You know, it was just a slice of people being around airplanes who like airplanes, you know, wives, sons, daughters, puppies, dogs. You know, I was sitting next to a bird nest, and there was a bunch of birds, a birdhouse, and inside were a bunch of birds chirping away, you know, joining in the conversation. So it was a beautiful afternoon.
Cool. I love it. I love it. Max, how about you? Anything aviation related to report?
I do, but I just have to tag on about Lock Haven and say that I once flew in there for their annual, I forget what they call it, but it's when Piper Cubs fly back home to the factory, and there were just Cubs everywhere all over the field there, and great fun. I bought an artist picture of a Piper Cub in the air, and it was signed by William Piper Jr., and it still hangs in my my family room, which is kind of fond memory. And what's really neat is you can actually identify the local area because you can see a hill in the background, and there's a large gravel slide that occurred many years ago where the trees are just completely gone, and that's in the painting. So you can look at it and go, yep, there's the Susquehanna River, and I know exactly where that spot is. So it's kind of fun. Well, let's see. Aviation News Talk. This week we interviewed Catherine Cavagnaro. She is the 2020 CFI of the Year for the U.S., and she's also a monthly contributor to AOPA Pilot Magazine, and she has a PhD in mathematics. She's a professor in Tennessee, and she is an expert on spins. So she is our spin doctor. So we
she also sounds smarter than you.
Oh, definitely. There's no question about that. So she is just a delight, and I think probably one of her strengths is taking complicated things and explaining it simply. So we started with the basic of stall and kind of went all the details of spins, and so it's a fun hour on Aviation News Talk this week.
So I know we've talked about it before, but I think it's been a while. Maybe explain to us or for us how the CFI of the year is chosen.
Well, it's a multi-step process. You figure there are roughly 60 to 70 FAA regional offices called FISDOs scattered around the country, and that's where all the local inspectors, you know, are based. And so each FISDO goes through a process where they select a CFI of the year, as well as there are three other categories as well. There's the avionics technician of the year, the essentially the mechanic of the year, the ANP person of the year, and also the fast team rep, so the safety rep of the year. So these are all people who don't work for the FAA, but people who, you know, are out in industry working. And so then they take the 60 or 70 people that have been selected at each of these offices, and then they go to the regions. And I forget how many regions there are in the U.S. I want to say somewhere on the order of 8, maybe 9. I'm here in the Pacific region. And then they select a winner in each of those 4 categories in each of the regions. So that's 8 or 9 different people in 4 different categories. And then from there, it goes out of the FAA's hands, and there is aviation group of people, which is selected by the people that run the GA awards program, and they pull people from different parts of industry. So there'll be representatives from AOPA and from EEAA and other organizations, and they go through a process where they evaluate each of these regional winners, and then they select one person in each of these different categories. And then that person gets their award at AirVenture, and it's almost always presented by the FAA administrator, which is kind of fun because you're in front of a crowd of about 2,000 people. The I got some really great advice in 2008 when I was about to go out in front of those 2,000 people and receive my award and give my brief presentation. The person said to me, "Now, when you go out to speak, be brief. Most of the people here are for the comedian who's on after," which is exactly what Sandy Hill told me. Sandy unfortunately passed away this past year, but he and his wife are the people that have run that program in the past.
Wow, that's very cool. Yeah, when you received that, you must have just felt really wonderful.
Oh, it was great. Yeah, there's no question. It's kind of a validation that says, hey, you know, all that stuff you do, all those hours you spend on weekends and at nights, just trying to create things to help people and help keep pilots safe, yeah, it gets noticed. And, people, want to do something to kind of recognize, people who are, working away trying to, make our industry even safer.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute, Mr. Trescott. Aren't you leaving out some part of What's Up with the Geeks about something to do with AOPA that maybe a little Texas birdie told me about? Maybe a flight training magazine? Isn't there something going on that you need to tell us there?
That's true. If people look at the July issue of Flight Training Magazine, there is an article in there that talks about me. I wish I'd thought to bring it up, but it's talks about... Yeah, they often feature somebody in each issue. So they featured me in this particular issue, And they talked about how you can have a career, you know, be your own boss, and really enjoy flying. But they worded it far more eloquently than that. So, yes, I was interviewed a couple months ago, and it just came out on the 1st of July.
Cool.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, Micah, you have a good news story for us, I think.
Well, yeah. It was in the Bangor Daily News, of all things. And what happened was they did up in the Dover Foxcroft Airport up in northern Maine back in the end of June. And they did a little this year's Northeast Stole, the short takeoff and landing series. They stopped in Dover and they played their game of who could take off the shortest and land who could take off and land the shortest and to see who could win that contest. And they reported that it was a great time. They showed all sorts of pictures and people doing it in a social distance kind of way. 10 pilots competed, and I believe the winning distance was taken by Bob Bradeen, who from Sterling, Alaska, who won with 268 feet. And then the next the person that came in second was a local person from Cape Elizabeth, Maine, who made it at 293 feet. But the problem with reading about something like this in the local paper is it doesn't give the aircraft type.
Yeah.
It could have been a helicopter for all I know.
So those distances that you mentioned, that's the sum of the takeoff and landing distances?
Yeah, each pilot, they make three runs at a distance on one runway, and they measure the takeoff and the landing, and they combine the distances, and that gives you the from their best, and that's what gives them the score.
And do they go around the pattern to do that? They don't just take off and then immediately cut the power and land?
No, it goes around the pattern.
Right, okay, good.
And is this an event that's held annually in Maine?
Yeah, it is annual in Maine, and I guess it's a nationwide kind of contest that they do, and people come in from all over. And this Alaskan bush pilot obviously came here to take the prize.
Wow, this is something that I want to go to next year. I think that sounds like a blast.
I think it'd be a great time. I think it'd be a lot of fun. And, it's a drive from Portland. It's probably a good 3.5-hour drive. Of course, if we had a train. Oh, no, that's another story.
Yeah. Damn train.
But it would definitely be worth doing. And if I hear about it next year ahead of time, and I certainly hope I do, I'll let you know. And let's do a run.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yes. Wow.
You know, and speaking of things that, David was talking about his experience this weekend, and my experience similar to that is always the Spurwink Farm pancake breakfast and fly-in, and it's supposed to happen this coming weekend, and it's exactly what David described, except that instead of hot dogs and sodas, it's pancakes and maple syrup, and it's just wonderful. But unfortunately, it's been postponed, at least from right now, as of right now, to August 9th. But I was in touch with the president of EAA Chapter 141, and they have another date set in September, assuming that August doesn't happen based on what the Maine state guidelines are. But nobody really expects that to happen either. It's really very, very sad. It's sad for so many reasons, because people won't be able to enjoy it, and also because that's the biggest fundraising event for EAA, for Chapter 141. And a lot of these poor chapters, you know, they're all very, very small chapters. These events aren't going to happen, and I'm very concerned for them.
Yes, yes. And I think the chapter, the EAA Chapter 141, has a Facebook page, and that's where maybe we'll learn about if it's on August 9th or pushed out or canceled or whatever happens, right?
Yeah, and we'll put that in the show notes, their Facebook page, so you can check on that. And there'll be pictures from other Spurwink Farms events. And I just got to thank, friend of the show, Ernie Eaton, helicopter pilot, who I've known him for a number of years, but he came down to Innovations in Flight last year, and a lot of us had a chance to meet him. He told me about it 2 years ago, and it's been the most fantastic time. I've been going this would have been my third year, and it's just a great time. And that's another thing, that if it happens next year, Max, we got to get you up here.
Yeah, I definitely. That's definitely on my list of events that I had intended to participate in this year. So if it doesn't happen next year, for sure. All right. Hey, one of the things that's fun about our Slack listener team, and you've heard us talk about that that team on Slack, is that our friend Isaac Alexander always puts in a This Week in Aviation History little thing that I think he gets from Speed News. Micah, there's some interesting things that happened this week in aviation history.
And you know what? There's a bunch of them on there, but one of my very, very favorite is the first one listed. Back in 1929, Delta Airlines was founded.
Wow. 1929.
Can you believe they've been in business that long? That's just amazing. Mm. And then 1951, we got to thank Isaac for this. He does such a great job putting together the first flight of the Lockheed L-1049 Super Constellation took place. And then skipped to 1978, and Boeing started the full scale development of the 767. And I guess our last week's guest, Miami Rick, has to give Boeing lots of thanks for that.
Right, right. Then in 1993, the Boeing C-17 was introduced. And boy, this one is really hard to believe for me. 1999, this week in 1999 was the week that John F. Kennedy Jr. was killed when he crashed the Piper Saratoga. Boy, it hardly seems like it was that long ago.
No, it certainly doesn't. And he took off from Essex County Airport in northern New Jersey, which was an airport where I had started doing my instrument training just before I moved to California, which is where I finished it up. So yeah, that was a bad night for everyone.
Yeah, so you can find those posts from Isaac in our Slack team. If I know a lot of you have joined the Slack team. For those of you who haven't, I know it's in some ways it's one more social media place. But what I like about it personally is that it's a really focused group. There's the signal to noise ratio is really high, unlike some other places where you might hang out in social media. It's all us airplane geeks talking about aviation, and much to my surprise, we have never needed to boot anybody out, even temporarily. Sometimes people get a little, out of control, maybe not intentionally. Sometimes people type things at the keyboard that they wouldn't say face-to-face to a human being. But, we haven't had any of that whatsoever. I've just been really grateful about that. So, yeah, and David will mention it again in a few minutes. But if you're interested in just taking a look at it, send us an email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll add you to the list. You'll get an email with credentials to get in. Check that out if you think you might be interested.
Hey, Max, before we get to the listener mail, let me go use the toilet. Oh no, wait.
Banned. Yeah. Listener mail. Yes, we did hear from Patrick Wiggins. He said, okay.
Speaking of the toilet. Sorry, Patrick.
He says, probably more of a space geeks than airplane geeks thing. Thought we might be interested. And he says, hey, there's enough prize money to get involved to buy a used airplane or maybe a Tesla. So this is the NASA Lunar Lou Challenge. That's right, Lou, L-O-O. And the idea here is NASA is looking for ideas, as they say, to help astronauts go back to the moon in 2024. NASA needs new designs for a toilet that will work both in microgravity and lunar gravity. And there actually is a cash prize from this, or for this. If you're the winner, it's $35,000. Not too shabby for a Lou design.
It's funny because one of the things that came up, our friend Stephen Trimble, who works for Aviation Week, mentioned this, that the Air Force issued requirements for two new products over the last week for the Air Force, which was a flight suit that's capable of supporting a maternity outfit or a maternity flight suit.
Wow.
The other interesting aspect was a design of in-flight relief systems specifically designed for women. The Air Force has had one for the men forever, but for long endurance flights, they haven't had one that's specifically designed for women. So it was those two different interesting things that you don't normally think about, but you know the Air Force is having to think because a lot of their crews now are females.
But you know, $35,000 for a toilet design, I just wonder how quickly I could piss that away.
Well, here's the thing I wonder, in all seriousness, how many of you here on the show today believe that we'll actually get back on the moon in 2024?
That's a good question. I feel less informed this time around, I'll say, as to what all the steps are to get us there. So I don't know if we can, you know, what they are that we need to accomplish in that time.
It feels kind of strange because rather than doing it for the first time when we were experimenting all along to see what we needed to do and learning how to do it, it's like we know how to do it now, and now we're trying to figure out how to find someone else to pay for it.
I hope we remember how to do it.
Well, I you know, Max, in all fairness, I have to admit the fact that we actually put astronauts into the International Space Station from Florida again.
Yeah.
That seemed to buoyant my hopes. The technology's there. The only holdup is, and this came out today, the major launch system to go to the moon is produced by a company called Boeing. Mm-hmm. And it's having cost overrides, and right now they're not convinced it has enough thrust to go off the ground. And that came out in the news today. So Boeing is admitting that. So another product that Boeing is playing with that, okay, you know, if they need enough thrust to go to the moon, it's called a Saturn V. Just rebuild it and we'll be fine. But I have to admit, it's kind of like us reinventing. It feels like we're reinventing the wheel with all of this.
Yeah, well, it's been so long. You know, the institutional knowledge, you know, gets lost. Building a Saturn V is probably only slightly more difficult than restarting an F-22 line, you know?
Agreed, you know, and but in a way, in sort of Micah's comment about doing it with somebody else paying for it and or doing it later, I mean, things like the launch system is going to be using the solid rocket boosters from the shuttle, the SRBs from the shuttle. Mm-hmm. You know, those sometimes you have to wonder, are you really saving money by borrowing technology that, you know, we'll just redesign part of it, but we'll use this. Sometimes it's better to do a clean sheet. Look at Mr. Musk and SpaceX, you know?
Yeah, I mean, nothing was really off the shelf in the original NASA stuff that we worked on when we went Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and right through the shuttle. We didn't use really anything off the shelf. Now that's what we're trying to do.
No, I think we did use something like 4% of the gross domestic product to fund NASA. So it was horrendously expensive, which is why I think it got scaled back so rapidly afterwards. When I was a kid, I was absolutely convinced we'd be on Mars within 20 years after that.
Oh, and sure.
We haven't been back to the moon in 50 some years. Let's see, I think we were last there in 1972. So what about 48 years ago? My personal, you know, if I had to guess, I'm going to guess it's going to be after 2024 before we get back to the moon, just because I think, you know, we tend to be optimistic when we put together our schedules, and I'm thinking something is going to come up. And, you know, David, I think, brought up, you know, one possibility, which is, hey, there could be, you know, issues with the boosting system. So my guess is probably not 2024. I would tack a couple more years on it is my guess before we have people walking on the moon again.
Well, if we go to 2029, that will be the 60th anniversary of Apollo 11. But that's really kind of frightening that I will be turning 60. And that, because I started with this Apollo 11, and I hope I live to see us going back to the moon. But there's an old saying, space is hard.
Yes.
You know what we should do? When we had our Zoom meetup a couple of weeks ago, Bill Barry was on, and he announced, you know, while he was on there that, you know, this is his last month, and he's finally, congratulations, Bill, he's going to retire. Once he's retired, let's get him on and find out the real inside story of NASA.
unfortunately, his real expertise happens to be the other side, Russian rockets.
Yes.
All right. We also had an email from our friend Errol, and he writes and says, I think the possibility of drive-in air shows has already been discussed, but here's one being organized in the UK, set up for picnicking by your car. And this is at Shuttleworth. So we'll have a link to that. They're planning on some basically drive-in air shows for this year, 2020. Interesting, way to address the issue of social distancing and being able to conduct air shows. And Errol also notes that events in Australia and New Zealand, he says, demonstrate the level of certainty required before organizers will commit to major events. He says New Zealand's only known cases are in isolation facilities. So there's a compulsory 14-day isolation at border entry. And there hasn't been any community transmission for a couple of months. The three-day air shows planned for February and April 2021 have confirmed that they are planning to go ahead, although with less international participation. It's interesting. It says mainly this is in the form of display pilots and visitors rather than aircraft, so less international participation than normal. He says they are hoping that normal travel is available between Australia and New Zealand by then. Isn't that amazing? We're talking about 2021, and they're hoping for normal travel between Australia and New Zealand by then. But currently, New Zealand only has the border measures as COVID procedures. And so it's, you know, interesting to see what's going on there. One of the characteristics of this pandemic is how it's in pockets. You know, it's in certain countries or certain areas of larger countries, and of course, all that makes planning events, air shows, and other events kind of difficult.
Yeah, and it does really change. In fact, I just heard on NPR today, they just closed down the border in Australia between New South Wales and Victoria. So you can't go from Melbourne to Canberra, Sydney, or Newcastle any longer until they get some of this straightened out. And Australia was doing really well. Hmm. It's a scary time.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, on that less than happy note, we'll wrap up this episode. I want to thank all of you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Hope you enjoyed the conversation. You can find us, as always, at airplanegeeks.com. There you'll find show notes for every episode, how to find us on social media, how to subscribe to the podcast, learn more about us. Also, we have a direct link to the show notes you can use, shortcut. That's airplanegeeks.com/611. And, of course, you can reach us on email or via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So, David Vanderhoof, where do we find you online?
Well, I'm happy to announce that, you know, this week when this comes out, the day after, I will be at work.
Yay!
At the American Helicopter Museum. So I will be less online, and I'm very thankful for that. But otherwise, you can find me on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn. You can also find me on our Slack listener team, like Max advertised earlier this evening. And you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And last but not least, you can find me on Friday mornings with Max Flight on the UAV Digest. And we've started a new pattern, it seems like, every other week. But we're going to have a guest this week, so we're looking forward to listening to that.
Great, great. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, they'll probably find me here in California. I'm going to try and dash out to the airport this week because I'm missing it badly, especially after all these great stories we've been talking about for airplanes. I need to go back and touch one and feel one.
Yeah.
Too good to not be doing. Anyway, people can find me in all the usual places. Just head out to aviationnewstalk.com. Click on contact at the top of the page. You can shoot me an email. And if you want to either leave a listener question, or we have listeners sometimes tell us about their favorite airport, which we call our fun flying destinations, they can also record 90 seconds by just clicking on listener question at the top, and that will generate an audio file, which will come straight to me.
Great. And Micah, You're kind of everywhere in some respects, but where can we find you, listen to you, check you out?
You know, I can't really be in two places at once when I'm really nowhere at all. But that's another story. You can get me via email at Micah, M-I-C-A-H, at airplanegeeks.com. And mostly I'm on Twitter is where I hang out. And on Twitter, I'm Maine, M-A-I-N-E, like the state, Maine Fly.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on LinkedIn at the UAVDigest.com, talking about unpiloted aviation with David. I'm trying not to say unmanned.
Yeah, we are really struggling with that one.
Yeah, we are. Unpiloted, it just seems kind of... Anyway, talking about drones on the UAV Digest, and also with Mary Kirby, talking about the passenger experience at paxxpodcast.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Wear a mask, wash your hands, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening.